Hello, my friends. It is time for another episode of Radio Deza, your favorite show on the RWA network. Today, we are going to talk about religion and topics broadly related to religion, starting with the history of Slavic paganism and modern era heresies in the Russian Church, or the split away from the Russian Church. I want to begin with an interesting anecdote or theory. There's a theory produced by Lev Samuilovich Klein, or as he is known in the English-speaking world, Leo Klein, who was a famous Russian Jewish archaeologist and anthropologist and philologist, so an academic, Soviet era. He was born in 1927, he is still alive currently. And he contributed a lot of fields. He was also active in the dissident community, and he wrote on very interesting things. He coined the term theoretical archaeology and contributed a lot to this field. Some of his theories were well received, some others not. He was a major contributor to the resurrection of the Norman theory of the creation of the Russian state, which was not very liked in the Soviet Union, and basically anti-Normanism was a very early theory in Russian. It was defended by Lomonosov, who was of course one of the founders of modern Russian science, but in the Romanov Empire it was more or less official state narrative that the Normanist theory is correct, in part because the ruling dynasty, of course, derived their legitimacy from the Norman Rurikovichs. And he also wrote a lot about ancient Indo-European history. For example, he came up with the Phrygian migration theory, the Phrygian migration millennium before the March of Alexander the Great. He wrote a lot on Homeric studies, on the Iliad, on the Odyssey. So he was quite broadly active. And one of the more interesting themes is his study of East Slavic pagan religion, especially what he wrote about Slavic religion in the Caucasus. When talking about Russians or Slavs in the Caucasus, most people will probably think about the 19th century, Chakassian and Chechen wars the Russian Empire fought there, and how this was the period when the region was colonized by Russia, which is of course quite wrong. People who are more in the know will maybe remember the 16th century and how the Terek Cossack host settled there and Russian colonists started settling down in this area and fighting, basically driving the peoples who lived there to the mountains. And some more specialist people with more specialist knowledge will remember the Tmutarakan principality, which was a medieval Russian state centered where in the ancient Greek colony of Hermonassa, lying in the Cimmerian Bosporus, so the passage from the Black Sea to the Azov Sea on the Taman Peninsula. In the 17th century, supposedly, Tmutarakan came off under Russian control, and from there was also some expansion toward the Caucasus. And there are some historical or legendary stories about Mstislav the Brave of Chernigov, who had a legendary duel with Trededi, a Caucasian hero from legend, or maybe from history, we don't know exactly. But anyway, all this might have been also not the first contact of Russians in the Caucasus, because in 1985, Leo Klein published the article Perun on the Caucasus in the journal Soviet Ethnography. So at that moment, the neo-pagan movement did not yet exist, except for Valery Yemelyanov, who published his book Desionization, which was published in the Syrian Arab Republic, as it could not be published in the Soviet Union, in which he argued for resurrection of Slavic paganism in Russia. So there was basically no political foundation for what Klein was writing. It was purely academic and he had no, you know, agenda. So Klein, I think he enjoyed writing about nationalist myths and kind of debunking them. He wrote on Aryogenesis, so Klein had the theory that the catacomb cultures of the Black Sea region were the ancestors of the Indo-Europeans, which before him was a theory also promulgated by Grandowski. He wrote about, as I said, the Norman theory and the ethnogenesis and the religion of the ancient Slavs. In the early 80s, Klein, while studying Chechen and Ingush folklore, he stumbled upon some weird things. He got his hands on a compendium of local Northern Caucasian myths, and in three of those myths, a strange figure is mentioned, who is called either Piron or Pira, who is the son of Sela. And Sela is the god of thunder in ancient Northern Caucasian religion and among the Vainakhs. Specialists in Chechen folklore, they thought that Piron or Pira is an equivalent to the Firaun from the Quran, so basically the Pharaoh from the Bible. But the legends, they confirm his very strange status. So he lives to be 500 years old, he argues with God, and he calls himself the Lord of Thunder and Rain. He constructs bronze spheres in the sky, and he pours water from the skies on the earth. God, he in this myth, he suffers Pirion's weird behavior because he has three good qualities, virtues that God likes. So he respects the elder, he is nice to children, and he has a reverent attitude to bread. Pirion, he has the ability to go to the netherworld and return back. In one of those Chechen myths, he is in a competition with his brothers, who are figures from Nart folklore, so also figures that sometimes appear in various Northern Caucasian mythologies. And he provides people with watermills, so he teaches people how to build watermills and becomes a hero. And in the end he dies because of some witch who doesn't like him. So then Klein, he tries to compare the data he gathered from Chechen Weihnacht folklore with Indo-European mythology, the mythology of the Lord of Thunder, the Thunder God, so Deus Pater. And he thinks that there is some kind of relic tradition of Pirun worship, who was, of course, the Thunder God of the Slavs in those traditions. So Klein engages in what we call comparative mythology nowadays, and he tries to find traces of Pirun. And he thinks that he succeeds in this, although some of those are quite far-fetched, and obviously he's just trying to prove his theory right. And he finds traces of Pirun worship in certain fertility rites, and in the end he identifies Pirun, the Slavic god, not only with the Indo-European thunder god, but also the dying and resurrecting god of fertility, so kind of Dionysian. And there were many rituals in Northern Caucasian folk religion or folk paganism that we would identify as Dionysian if compared with their Greek counterparts. So basically what Klein is saying is that the figure of Pirion or Piria in Chechen folklore or pre-Islamic Chechen folklore or Weihnacht folklore is proof that there was either Slavs living in the Caucasus or at least having contact with the pre-Islamic Northern Caucasian population. But there is some other proof or like interesting theories about Slavs living in the Caucasus way before they are historically supposed to. There is, for example, the medieval or early medieval Armenian chronology called the History of the Country of Agvank, sometimes rendered as the History of the Country of Albania in English, which refers to Caucasian Albania, which is an a modern term for a country or realm that existed in the Caucasus in ancient times in what is now Azerbaijan and Armenia. The endonym is Agvank, so the history of the land of Agvank. They mention, the chronicle mentions the invasion of Khazars in Caucasian Albania in the middle of the 7th century, and among other things, it describes the mores and habits of the nomad horde. So during the raids, the nomads, it describes the nomads covering the lips with a fat that the Armenian chronist describes as saloy. So sala, which is still a word used in Russian and Ukrainian and maybe other Slavic languages, I'm not sure, but it refers simply to pork lard. And aside from that, he says that they call their drinking vessels shor. And it is quite possible that this word has an Eastern Slavic etymology, because in the dictionary of Vladimir Dal, who was the most famous lexicographer and a founding member of the Russian Geographical Society and an expert in all things language and folklore, he records the word shorom in several Siberian dialects. So it was still in use in the Russian language. It is quite possible that there were Slavs among the Khazar army, and there are other mentions of Slavs and Russians on serving the Khazar Khaganate. So it is possible that Slavs were invading the Caucasus together with the Khazars. The Baghdad-born historian Al-Baladuri, one of the most important Middle Eastern historians of his age, also compiled a book called Kitab Futuh al-Buldan, may all Arab listeners forgive me for my pronunciation, which translates as Book of the Conquests of Lands. And there he describes a military operation beyond the mountains of Kapk. After a defeat by the Khazars in the Battle of Al-Dibil, the governor Marwan in the year 737, burning with a desire to avenge the defeat he suffered at the hands of the Khazars, he turned to the north and destroyed the Caucasian realms of the Khazar Khaganate. He burned down both large cities in the region, and the Khazars ran, and then the Arab army were following them to a river he calls the Slavic River, or of course he refers to it as the River of the Sakalibs. Sakaliba is what the Arab chronicles name the Slavs, but there is some contention among historians and philologists whether the word refers only to Slavs or to the whole population of the region, so Turks and Finno-Ugrians and so on. But in this context, he means specifically Slavs, because he mentions Sakaliba being taken prisoners together with other Kafirs. The Khazars, they react to this defeat by asking for peace and pretending to speak the Shahada. Marwan, he returned home with his loot and took 20,000 people prisoner, among them Slavs and Khazars. And the border between the Khalif and the Khaganate, it was precisely along the Caucasus. So the primary sources say that the Sakalibs, who may be Polonians or other Slavic tribes, they were settled in Kakhetia, and the Khazars were settled in the lowlands of Dagestan. The Sakalibs, or Slavs, soon rebelled and killed their Arab governor and fled again to the north. And supposedly they were hunted down and all killed. And after that, we kind of lose track of both groups. So the Caucasus was destroyed by wars, or ravaged by wars. The Hazars returned to the north and moved their capital city to Itil, and the cities of Baida and Semender were deserted. Marwan ibn Muhammad, also known as Marwan II, soon or many years later, became the 14th caliph of the Umayyad dynasty, and well, then the Abbasid revolution happened, and there was a lot of civil war, and all members of his clan, of the Muawis, were fled. Some, I think the last of them fled to Andalusia and became the Emir of Cordoba. But anyway, in the political life of this period, the Sakalib, well, something like proto-Janissaries, or like an equivalent of the Varangian Guard of the Byzantines. So the Umayyads had their own Slavic guard, and they took part in this, the political life in this period and in the civil war that came with the Abbasid revolution. There are other scattered references, for example, of Russian raiders who are called Ushkuyniki, which is more or less just the equivalent of the word Viking, who were raiding the Caspian Sea or beyond. For example, there was allegedly or supposedly a large raid in 913-914, where they acquired a lot of loot, and the army was wintering near Baku, but it didn't return home. And there are two versions of why they didn't return to Russian lands. According to one, they well converted to Islam and stayed in the Caucasus. And according to the other version, they were ambushed by Hazars and destroyed. There are also some references to raids on Derbent, the ancient capital of Dagestan, and some chronicles mention Russians raiding the Alan lands. So, yeah, they were supposedly at least raiding over all of the Caucasus, at least the parts that were kind of possibly reached by the sea or by rivers. The next confirmed contact between Russians and the Caucasus happens in the 15th, 16th century. There were envoys to Georgia, dynastic marriages with the local nobles from Kabardin nobles, and of course the creation of the Terek Kossa coast, and mentioned by a Turkish traveler and writer, Evli Celebi, who said that Lezgins, who are people who live in Dagestan, they prefer to trade with Russians and not with Persians, because the Persians shave their beards, which the Russians don't. So the Russians then, the Russian settlers, the Russian frontier population, it comes into contact with Vainakhs, so Chechens, Circassians, and other Turkish peoples, which becomes a part of folklore. Tolstoy himself, he described the Grebensk Cossacks, who became quite close to the Chechens and took Chechen brides and so on. There are some tapes. So a tape is a Chechen tribe or clan who have close ties to Russians, and some Cossack families actually have lineages or like in their family legends that they are descended from Chechens who fled the Caucasus during the period of Islamization in the 15th century, 15th, 16th centuries. So basically the descendants of Chechen pagans. There is also a tape called Orsi, which is supposed to have Russian ancestry. So they are just Russians who joined the Chechens. The tapes, or clans, tribes, which are descended from people who are not Vainakhs, which is what the Chechens call themselves, do not are not counted among the Tukhum. The Tukhum are the Weinach tribes or fraternities or clans or whatever term you want to use, which are kind of like the tribes of Israel in Jewish mythology. So it's quite complicated structure, but there are tapes which are more or less officially not Chechen descended, and among them the Orsi are supposed to be Russians. But if we engage in vulgar crypto-ethnology, we can find even more interesting things. For example, as I've mentioned before, Marwan took many Slavs prisoner, and they were supposedly settled in Kakhetia, which is in modern-day Georgia. So it would be logical to seek out the descendants of these people among the mountain peoples in Georgia. There is, for example, a book by the Russian officer and historian Arnold Zisserman, so of course an immigrant from Germany, who was a colonel in the cavalry during the Caucasian Wars, and he wrote a book called 25 Years in the Caucasus. And in this book he remembers a local legend that the Hefsurians, a small group in Georgia, who live on both sides of the Caucasus, along the rivers Aragvi and Targum. And supposedly, according to local legend, they are descendants of crusaders. The Hefsurians are good candidates for these supposed descendants of a population that mixed with Slavs, because they are supposedly have a pretty bright complexion and blonde hair and light eyes and so on. And they have some surviving pagan rituals, and according to Russian ethnographers, they practiced a peculiar mix of Christian, Muslim, and Jewish religious rituals, which might also point to the fact that they might be descendants of some kind of Slavic Khazarian substrate. But this is not everything. There are other Western or European descendant peoples, supposedly in the Caucasus. For example, among the Circassians, for a long time, lived the so-called Frankardashi, who were descendants of the Genoese peoples who were serving as mercenaries in the various wars there, or merchants and so on. And of course, the Goths, who lived both in Crimea and in the Caucasus, also left some traces in history. There is one theory that the name of the mountain range, Caucasus itself, is derived from a Gothic term, Haukas, which just means up or above or high. It is, of course, quite interesting to think about the penetration of the lost Slavs from Georgia through the Caucasus to the Weinach lands, and of course from the Khazar Khaganate to Alania, and so on and so on. Then there are the Arshtin, who are claimed to be both by the Chechens and the Ingush, to be part of their respective nations, but also figure in some local mythology as descendants of Russians, and in Chechen folklore they often appear together with the figure of the Russian Cossack and so on. But I'm getting carried away a bit right now, so let's get back to what I actually wanted to talk about, which is heresies and sects in Russian history. So the first heresy we need to talk about is one that appeared several times in Russian history and seemingly not connected. It is the heresy of the Judaizers. It is quite related to the heresy that appeared in the Byzantine Empire in the 14th century. It was described by Palamas, who called them Jews. They were called the Hions or Hionians, Hionoi, described in a dispute by Palamas that supposedly occurred in 1354 near Bursa. It happened while Palamas was a prisoner of the Turks, and the Hionians and Turks on the other side. It appeared that the Hionians or Hirons weren't Turks by ethnicity, but said of themselves that they became Turks when they left behind their former religion, which was Orthodox Christianity, and took on the commandments of Moses, as they described. So they regarded themselves as Muslims, although they, they were a strange mix of Islam and Judaism. It appears that they gained some influence in former Byzantine lands, and Parmas recorded his discussions with them about their heretical religion. So basically they described themselves as Jews, but also as Muslims. And as I said, it's a very strange religion mix. And they might have been Karaims, or like the ancestors of the Karaims, and some people derived the etymology of from the word Zion, simply. There are other versions, for example, from Eschaim, so the tree of life in Hebrew. And it's all unclear where they came from or how they appeared. They also were connected somehow to the Bulgarian Judaizers and, of course, to the Judaizers who later appeared in Novgorod. But we don't know much about the Byzantine Judaizers. So, anyway, the Judaizers, they appeared in Novgorod in the late 15th century after a certain Jew named Zachariah, or Skara in Russian, there are several versions of the name, came to Novgorod from Lithuania. And he was teaching Judaism, and some Christians, they created kind of a religion or sect or heresy based on the teachings of this Zachariah, which was closer to Judaism than to the ruling Orthodox Christianity. The main opponent and main source we have for the beliefs of the Judaizers is Saint Joseph of Olotsk, who was a theologian and a great defender of the monasteries, and the Archbishop Gennady of Novgorod, who was also a great enemy of this heresy. So they were persecuted very harshly, many were burned at the stake, and this is one of the reasons why Ivan the Terrible had such an attitude towards Novgorod and destroyed the city, because the city wasn't doing enough to combat the Judaizer heresy. It is a very strange thing that appeared, because basically you had random Orthodox Russian peasants becoming Jews and observing the Shabbat and so on, and following Jewish dietary laws and awaiting the Messiah and so on and so on. So basically, like, in form and content, it was more or less normal Judaism while keeping some Christian elements, and as they were very harshly persecuted, and they reappeared many hundred years later, in the late 18th century. They were calling themselves Subotniki, so Subota is the Russian word for Saturday, so Sabbath, and these people were basically the same as the Judaizers of the medieval period, and they also had close contact with the Jewish communities, with the Crimean Karaims, with the Ashkenazim, who were living in the Pale of Settlement. And it's all quite interesting why this Jewish heresy appeared at separate times in completely different ways in Russia. Some historians think that the first Judaizers weren't actually connected to Jewish communities at all, and that they were either in direct communication with Bulgarian Bogomils, who also were connected to the Khazars, or the Messalian heretics. and other mystic sects that were around in that time. But others, especially church historians, thought that they were more or less converts to Judaism. So there is no one clear theory of what the Judaizers were. There were some Israeli specialists, Professor Taube, for example, who thought that Zakaria wanted to convert the Russians into Judaism because of some mystical vision that had appeared through him, and basically that he wanted to crypto convert the Russians into Judaism, so that they were supposed to think that they were still Christians, which they kinda did, but at the same time he wanted them to follow Jewish law. So it's all quite strange. The Judaizer heresy was also used in internal politics, of course. You had Yelena Stefanovna, the wife or daughter of Stefan III of Moldavia, and daughter of Eudokia Orelkovna of Kiev. She converted to this heresy, which also was the point at which it became a political struggle. So you had different factions either having positive or negative attitudes to the Judaizers. But at the Sabor of 1503, it was finally decided that, it was decided that they were to be combated at any costs. And then they were harshly persecuted, as I said before, and many of them were killed. So there is a Russian chronicle about Vlad the Impaler from the late 15th century, which is a lot more positive than Western propaganda, where he is depicted mostly as a tough but fair type, but also, as having a very harsh and strict personality. So not quite positive, but more positive than in Western leaflets and books of the time. It was also one of the first, if not the first, independent novel-like works in the Russian language, The Legend of the Voivoda Dracula. It was written by Fyodor Kuritsin, who was a Russian diplomat and writer and traveler, who was one of the main defenders of the Judaizers and one of the most prominent members of this sect. He was also a friend of Tsar Ivan III, which further complicated matters. And he lived at the same time as Joseph of Volotsk, and it was all complicated. After 1504, his brother Ivan Volk was killed by the government of Ivan III, and we don't know the fate of Fyodor Kuritsin himself, but we know that his son Afanasy Kuritsin, he had some prominence at the court of Vasily III. So, and his descendants played a role in the political life of the country until the 17th century. So obviously the whole family was not being punished for the sin of Fyodor Kuritsin. So there is no single source from which we can derive the theology or worldview of the Judaizers. What we know comes mostly from the writings of Joseph of Volotsk and other polemics against them, but we know some of the books they read. So they read Maimonides, that we know. They read Al-Ghazali. They read Pseudo-Aristoteles. And they read Al-Harizi. So a lot of imported literature from the West, especially from Spain and the Provence, so lots of Sephardim literature, which further kind of makes the point that, there weren't many Ashkenazim at that time in Russia anyway, but that the first Judaizers didn't really have any connection to the Ashkenazim communities of Eastern Europe, aside from aforementioned Zakaria, about whom we really don't know much at all. And it is all quite complicated. Supposedly, Zakaria was some kind of noble from the Caucasus, maybe a Karaim or something like this. There is a version that he was a scholar from Kiev. We don't know for sure, and we don't know for sure what the Judaizers believed. We don't know for sure. We know for sure that they did not consider themselves heretics. We know that they considered themselves true Orthodox Christians, but nevertheless, they were considered, well, converts to Judaism and apostates, and those were harshly condemned. In the 17th, 18th, until the 20th century, they had somewhat of a revival, as I've said, the Subotniki. They were much closer to regular Jewish communities in Russia. Some of them later even emigrated to Israel. And I think even now there are supposedly some communities who are in contact with their local synagogues and so on. They were also, the Subotniki were also harshly repressed under Emperor Nikolai I. And yeah, so much for the Judaizers. We don't know much about them. We can make some educated guesses. We can see some possible connections to the Bogomils, to the Massalians, to the Khazars, even maybe to Frankists, perhaps at least for the later Subotniki movement, but of course not for the original Judaizers, to the Byzantine Hionians or Hierans. But it's a mystery, we don't know for sure. We just know that a bunch of people in Russia in the 15th century suddenly decided to follow Jewish law and become Jews in all but name, and that the same thing happened again 300 or 200 years later. But that's the extent of what we know. So another large heretic community that we have to talk about in this context are the Huisti. They are a mystical sect, and according to their own legends, they appeared in the 17th century, almost at the same time as the Great Schism happened in the Russian church, and the old believers split from the mainstream church, and according to their own Huisti legends, the Tsar Alexei Mikhailovich and the Patriarch Nikon were the first Huisti. So it is not completely clear where they came from. And there are four main points of view on how they appeared. So the first one is that they are a result of Protestant mystic sects and Freemasonry. The second hypothesis is that they are a result of earlier southern influence from the Bulgarian Bogomils, and even through them, even older, from the Manichaeans. So still kind of connected to the Judaizers, who were also rumored to be connected to the Bogomils. Then the third one is a theory that the Huisti were an, well, Russian movement that appeared in Russia that is connected to Slavic paganism and esotericism. And the fourth one, which posits that the Huisti are independent movement that appeared in the religious life of the 17th century, namely that they kind of grew out of the Russian Orthodox tradition of Hesychasm and some radical lines of thought in among the old believers. So there are some people who believe that the Huisti are even older than the 17th century. For example, Melnikov Pichersky, a Russian writer and ethnographer, he posited that the Huisti already existed under Ivan the Terrible. And in their own folklore and even some of their songs, they are mentioning some Huisti who were active in the times of Dmitry Donskoy and Ivan the Terrible. The traditionally, as the founder of the Huisti movement, is thought the Russian peasant Danila Filipovich. Supposedly in 1645, on the mountain Gradina, he was, the Danil Filipov was visited by God and was given 12 new commandments. And well, so that was kind of the beginning of the Huisti movement. But as often with matters of religious history, it's hard to be sure of anything. What we know is that their theology is quite peculiar. They believe that heaven and earth exist. They believe in a spiritual and a material world, that the spiritual world was created by God and the material world by Satan himself, that there are seven heavens, and well, it is this kind of dualism does appear quite often in different heresies, but I'm not sure that you can say that these are basically all the same, because the ideas go back to like 4th century Gnosticism. But the most similarities with the Huisti were found in the mystical sects of medieval and even modern Europe and America, so like the Adamites, the Quakers, and so on. And in this view, as I've already said, some scholars of the Huisti believe that it is a phenomenon imported from the West. According to others, as I've said before, or also it's nothing else than Bogomilism transplanted through to Russia at the time of Saint Vladimir, who baptized Russia. Other scholars consider the Huistovshchina to be an original creation of Russia, but it is probably that most valid is some kind of middle opinion, according to which the dualistic metaphysics of the Huisti could be formed under the influence of pagan beliefs of that had survived until the appearance of the sect, and partly under the influence of Bogomilian ideas as well, which spread in Russia through apocryphal writing. The Huisti also have a doctrine of the pre-existence of souls and the transmigration of souls, which may have been borrowed from very ancient pagan beliefs. Yes, so the doctrine, which is inherent basically in all mystics, of direct communion with God may lead to the idea that man not only enters into this communion, but also takes Godhead into himself, so is deified and becomes himself God. And since in the pantheistic view, deity is everywhere, and from the mystic pantheistic standpoint, it is natural that many gods would simultaneously appear. So anyways, according to Huisti history, the successor of Daniil Filipovich was Ivan Suslov, also a Murom peasant who was transformed into a new Christ and acquired 12 apostles, along with a woman who was given the title Mother of God, which was also a title that the Huisti used for women in general, because they believed in, well, that every Huist, or Christ, as they sometimes said, would be named, would become Christ and God overall. So, according to Huisti tradition, Suslov was crucified by the government twice and rose from the dead twice. But of course, there are no real sources that confirm the existence of either Filipovich or Suslov, so we don't really know anything about how they really appeared. Formally, they did not split from the Orthodox Church. They continued going to Orthodox liturgies, but they also had their own version of liturgy or communion, the so-called Radenie. These were an ecstatic practice and members of the community who had the status of prophets and prophet dresses were like jumping around and spinning and while shouting various prophecies. And the others were crying and laughing and just moving in ecstasy and falling to the ground and so on. So the Radenie of the Huisti were secret and outsiders were not permitted to go there, and thus there were many speculations about what actually happened there. So Melnikov-Pichersky, who I've already mentioned, him wrote, who was the first great specialist on the Huisti in Russia, he said himself that he knew of people who knew the Huisti personally, that they participated in strange rituals there, that they were engaging in orgies or practicing human sacrifice, but there is no real confirmation whether this really happened or not. They justified their extravagant rituals with the Bible, and especially 2 Samuel 6:14. And David danced before the Lord with all his might, and David was girded with a linen ephod. So that was how, why they did what they did, supposedly. The Huisti communities were named ships, the Noah's Ark, of course, and so, yeah. The leaders of these ships or communities were especially venerated. They were blessing food and drink. People were almost praying to them. And what makes this heresy different from others is that they got some attention from sympathetic attention from the upper classes, especially in the beginning of the 18th century. Under Alexander the First, there was kind of a relaxation in the state religion, since Alexander himself was rumored to be a mystic and had some, well, religious soul searching going on. Catholicism was very strong in Russia during his reign. Joseph de Maistre in St. Petersburg converted a lot of nobles to Catholicism, because they were kind of insecure in orthodoxy, because, well, the supposedly major orthodox person in Russia was kind of weird about religion. And Protestantism was also growing strong during that time. And, of course, Freemasonry. Freemasonry and various other mystical, esoteric schools of thought from the West came to Russia. And it all kind of mixed together The Russian intelligentsia, which at that point was quite interested in Freemasonry and mysticism, were sympathetic to the Huisti. For example, Alexander Lobzin, who was the publisher of the Zion newsletter, a philosopher and writer, and basically one of the major Freemasons in Russia, was very sympathetic to the Huisti. And even the Minister of Enlightenment, Alexander Galitsyn, Pavel Melnikov-Pichersky, he, aside from his ethnographical studies of the Huisti, he also wrote a novel about them. And people or members of the Narodniki or social democrat or like socialist movements, they were also placing their hopes in religious dissidents in their fight against the Tsar and the throne, which is kind of interesting because Huisti were also, well, very antinomian in some of their views. For example, they rejected basically all the normal sacraments, despite still going to church and considering themselves in communion with the church. But they had very captivating religious rituals, as I've said. They were rejoicing, singing, chanting, jumping around, dancing. And they had very special views on the relations between the sexes. They did not respect the sacrament of marriage in full. They preached abstinence, both in terms of like alcohol and sex, and but at the same time they were allowing people to marry and remarry again, and it's well, probably not quite that unusual compared to the many religious communities found in the West, but in Russia they were extremely strange and seemingly out of place. Out of the Huisti movement arose another religious movement. I guess it's the one people who know a bit about Russian sects or heresies first think of, it's the Skoptsi, the people who castrated themselves. The history of the Skoptsi is also quite interesting in several ways, and it all began quite, well, innocently, in as far as it is possible. On a summer day in 1771, Pyotr and Trofim, two peasants from the village of Maslovka near Oryol, went for a swim on the river. And they went swimming naked, of course, and then Trofim realized that Pyotr has no genitals. So he asked him, and everything Pyotr had to say for himself was that he had castrated himself for the purpose of not being united in the flesh with his wife. Pyotr asked Trofim not to tell anyone when they parted, but Trofim could not stand not sharing this news and told his wife. The wife went to the parish priest, the priest went to the board of bishops, and in addition sent Trofim's wife to gather evidence. An investigation by the church was launched. A commission headed by investigator Volkov found out the following. 8 years before Pyotr and Trofim went for a swim, a certain Andrei Blochin appeared in the village. At the age of 14, Blochin had left his home village and became a wanderer. He wandered the roads of Russia alone, but soon he was joined by two beggars, one of whom was a blind man. They went to fairs, they were asking for alms, and for 6 years they walked all around Russia. In the seventh year, Andrei Blochin met a certain someone, a man named Mikhail Nikulin, who was a Huist and also a prophet of the Huisti, a teacher of faith. And he introduced Andrei Blochin to the teachings of the Huisti. This movement was in full bloom in the late 18th century, and they were strolling through Russia, falling into a frenzy at their prayer meetings, and prophesizing the very soon end of the world. The Huisti were, as I've said before, not allowed to smoke, drink, or engage in intimacy with their spouses. Andrei really liked the ideas of the Huisti, and especially the part about carnal relations. And after some reflection and giving it some more thought, Andrei decided to develop the doctrine even further, and cauterized his testicles with a red-hot iron. After recovering from this surgery, Blochin continued wandering Russia, but of course the pace was no longer the same, and instead of aimlessly wandering between fairs asking for alms, the castrate decided to carry his ideas to the masses and settling near the village of Maslovka. And the first of his converts was a certain Kondraty Trofimov, also a wanderer and an old acquaintance of Blochin's. Inspired by Blochin's sermon, Kondraty took a knife and, well, started castrating himself. But Kondraty didn't have the balls to finish what he had started, and Blochin finished the job again with a searing hot piece of iron. And yes, so since then Kondraty himself learned how to carry out this operation and became the closest associate and assistant of Andrei Blochin. Well, his work was very difficult, so he needed more assistance. Blochin's idea fell on fertile ground in Maslovka and the surrounding villages. There were many all these villages were filled with Huisti. The leader of a local ship, a certain woman named Ivanovna, warmly received the new strangers and even declared Andrei Blochin to be both a resurrection of Christ and the rescued Tsar Peter the Third at the same time. And for the next 8 years, for whatever reasons, there was no shortage of people who decided to deprive themselves of their genitals. Even his teacher, Mikhail Nikulin, let himself be castrated by Blokhin, and during his interrogations he mentioned 61 people whom he castrated himself. It is a very complicated and interesting question why so many peasants let themselves be castrated by some insane guy who was wandering Russia for years. Yes, they were all already heretics, they were all Christi. Yes, they believed that soon the world would end. Yes, they believed in the modification of the flesh, but still, it is an extremely, extreme procedure. There is a Russian historian named Panchenko who has a rather strange explanation of what had happened. He connects the Skopje and the appearance of the Skopje movement to the introduction of the potato in Russia by Peter the Great. Supposedly, as was also the case in other European countries, for example in Prussia, the potato had to be introduced by quite violent means. And apparently among the Christi there was a folk belief that the potato was not a real crop, and instead it was the devil's testicles. So in some kind of symbolic, metaphorical way, they were protesting against the devil's genitals by cutting off their own, so they would not be led into seduction. It is quite strange version, but there aren't really any more conclusive explanations of why and how the Skopje movement gained in popularity. The Skopje also had managed to gain some adepts from the upper classes, and according to their own mythology, Tsar Alexander was one of them, but there was an unfortunate incident in which the two soldiers, both nephews of Count Mikhail Miloradovich, a war hero of Serbian origin, became Skopje and cut off their genitals. And after this, very harsh repressions began as the government finally decided to go all in on suppressing the Skopje. And there was a guy named Lysian who wanted to gather an army of 144,000 Skopje and conquer Moscow, from where he would rule Russia as a Skopje Tsar. So yeah, they lived in the underground ever since, but they did exist, and they survived for quite a long time actually. During and they had very strange views. There is some testimony from Idris Shah, famous Afghan Indian Sufi author, the author of many travelogues and cultural studies, among other things he wrote. He wrote that only ethnic Russians were introduced to the Skopje. Apparently in the Soviet Union they were regarded as monarchists and counter-revolutionaries. There was a process, a court case against the Skopje in St. Petersburg in the 1920s, where several editions of the protocols of the Elders of Zion were confiscated among the Skopje. So yes, they had very strange views on everything. But they did survive for quite a long time. As I've said, supposedly they still exist. So the Soviet researcher, historian, and religious scholar Alexander Klibanov, in 1971, He discovered some Skoptsy communities in Tambov and in Rostov, and there is some information about Skoptsy still surviving in Latvia, in Stavropol, and in the Northern Caucasus. So they probably still exist somewhere. Of course, the question of reproduction is quite complicated for people who castrate themselves, but many of them actually had children before they castrated themselves. So they first produced children and then they became full Skoptsy. And they also, well, of course, tried to convert people, which is quite complicated. But yes, so these were the apocalyptic people who cut off their own balls. And these are, I think, the main currents of heresies and sects and cults that were active in Russia. There are, of course, many less influential ones, or influential in terms of cultural significance, because, of course, the Skoptsy, because of their, peculiar traditions and honestly quite extreme practices, many books were written about them. Same with the Khwisty, who also always managed to captivate the public's imagination, and the Subotniki as kind of descendants of the medieval Judaizers. So these are the three, I think, main interesting ones, main major ones. But maybe I'll do another episode about minor groups. There are some quite interesting ones. Maybe I'll do an episode on the Old Believers, which are also very different from what one usually imagines, in the sense that they are often represented as just especially pious people who just wanted to be left alone, which is absolutely not what they were, or like many of them were exactly like this, but many of them also some fled to the Ottoman Empire and became basically slave raiders in the service of the Sultan. Many old believers had joined the Bolsheviks and even helped finance the Bolsheviks because they hated Russia and the Russian Tsar very much, as opposed to the Khwisty and Skoptsy, who actually never were especially anti-government, even when they were harshly persecuted by the Russian government. So it's all a quite large topic, and the Russian ktonic element is very strong and it may suck you in. And if you're not careful, it will do strange and bad things to your mind. Keeping that in mind, I hope you enjoyed the episode, and until next time, Radio Deza out.